Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're opening the vault on something that's just foundational for anyone in cultural heritage.
It really is.
We're taking a look at archive space, that specialized application that, well, thousands of places use to manage everything from archives to manuscripts, and now, more and more, digital collections.
Right.
And if you've ever wondered how, you know, a big university or historical society keeps track of literally everything, like a box of 19th century letters and a terabyte of photos.
Archive space is probably the answer.
Exactly. So our mission today is pretty simple. We just want to give you a clear, beginner-friendly way into this tool to understand what it does, why it even needs to exist, and how this really unique community model keeps it all going. Okay, let's unpack this.
Sounds good.
But first, a quick thank you to the supporter of this deep dive, SafeServer. SafeServer kümmert sich das Hosting dieser Software und unterstützt dich bei deiner digitalen Transformation. You can find more info at www.safeserver.de. Their support really does help us bring you these kinds of explorations.
So when we start talking about archive space, I think the first thing to get is its origin. It really is the leading open source tool for this. But it wasn't designed in a corporate boardroom somewhere.
Right.
It was literally built for archives by archivists.
Which feels important.
It's everything. This tool exists because the off-the-shelf stuff, you know, for libraries or museums, it just couldn't handle the complexity of archives, the way things are arranged, the hierarchy. It's just different.
So it was a necessity.
A total necessity.
Yeah.
The first version, Archive Space 1.0, came out in 2013. And it was this huge collaboration with places like NYU Libraries, UC San Diego, University of Illinois, all backed by the Mellon Foundation.
Yeah.
And with organizational help from Liracis. It was built to be stable from day one.
That phrase, built by archivists, that really sticks with me. Because you're right, a library might have thousands of individual books, one barcode each. But an archive, that's a whole different beast. It's millions of unique connected things in one collection.
Mm-hmm.
So why does that need its own software? What can archive space do that, say, a really good database couldn't?
It really boils down to two things. Maintaining what we call intellectual control and physical control. And doing both at the same time.
Okay.
It's a single system that supports the entire life cycle of archival work. Everything from the moment an item arrives to the moment a researcher finds it.
So let's walk through that life cycle. For someone new to this, the terms can be a bit technical.
Sure. So there are five essential stages.
What's the first one?
The first is accessioning. That's just the intake. The moment a collection comes through the door, you're recording what you got, who you got it from, the basic legal and procedural stuff.
So it's official record of arrival.
Yes.
Got it. What's next?
Second is arrangement. And this is critical. Archives aren't just random piles of stuff. They have an original order, the way the creator kept them.
Right, and that order has meaning.
Exactly. So the system lets you map out that hierarchy digitally so the original context isn't lost.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. What's number three?
Third is description. This is where you create all that crucial metadata.
Yeah.
Basically, you're writing the finding aids.
The roadmap for researchers.
Precisely. The guide that tells someone what's in box 3, folder 6. And Archive Space helps generate those in standard formats, like EAD. So they work everywhere.
So it does the heavy lifting on those really complex documents.
It does. Then fourth, you have preservation. This part tracks the physical side of things. Where is it located? What are the environmental conditions? Does it need conservation? All to ensure its long-term health.
And the last one.
And finally, number five is access. This is the payoff. It's the public interface that lets people actually search and discover all this amazing material, connecting all that back-end work to the researcher.
Wow. Okay, when you lay it out like that, yeah, spreadsheet just isn't going to cut it.
Not even close.
It really is an essential piece of digital infrastructure. And on the technical side, it feels just as solid. You can tell it's built to last.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have to get lost in the code, but the fact that it's built on a mature language, like Ruby says a lot, this isn't some quick web app. It's a serious platform meant for the long haul.
Which is what you need when you're managing history. And you see that reflected in the development activity. You can look at GitHub and see the numbers. 385 stars, 238 forks.
Which shows people are paying attention.
Right. But the number that really tells the story is the 96 contributors. That's not just a couple of developers. That's a dedicated community of professionals putting in their own time and expertise.
96 people.
Yeah.
That's a lot of brain power. And that kind of active dedication, that really brings us to the most fascinating part of this whole story.
It really is. Because what's so interesting here is that Archive Space isn't just software you download. It's a community.
In what way?
I mean, it's an organized body of archivists, librarians, developers, administrators, all working together. It's community-supported software. The users aren't just customers, they're the owners. They decide where the software goes next. They fund it, they manage it, they implement it.
That sounds amazing in theory, but how does that work in practice? I mean, are archivists expected to learn how to code in Ruby? Where does that technical skill come from?
That's a great question. And no, it's not all on the archivists. The development work tends to come from three main places. You have developers at member institutions, developers from vendor partners who host it, like SafeServer, and then the core program team, which the community's membership fees actually fund.
So there's a professional core.
A professional core, yes. Guided by the community. And you see that commitment all the time. Like, they just announced Martha Tenney is joining as the new standards and testing archivist. They're making sure everything stays up to professional standards. They're even planning their 2026 virtual member forum already. This is a very active, very organized ecosystem.
That active engagement must be what makes it work so well in the real world. And here's where it gets really interesting. When you hear from the people actually using it every day, like the testimonials tell the whole story. I was reading what Tessa Wakefield from the University of Northern Iowa said. She mentioned that it gives her staff more autonomy. They can manage things more effectively because they aren't waiting on some outside company.
They have a say in the tools they use.
Exactly. They can help build the solution they need. And it's not just the archivists. What about the IT staff?
Right. They're often the forgotten piece of the puzzle.
Totally. But Tom McNeely, he's IT at Western Washington University. He said it was pretty easy to install and upgrade. And he praised the technical documentation. When the IT team is happy, that saves everyone time and money.
That's a huge win. Good documentation is priceless.
It really is. But let's bring it back to the public, to the researchers. Yeah. The impact on discovery is just massive. Heidi Pettit at Loras College talked about going from over 100 separate finding aids to a single searchable collection in archive space. Can you imagine trying to do research by searching 100 different PDFs one by one?
That sounds like a nightmare. A unified system is a complete game changer for research.
It's a revolutionary leap. And that all comes back to that community governance. I think Bree McLaughlin at Indiana University put it perfectly. She said she appreciates that feedback and concerns are actually heard.
Mm.
That feeling of having a real voice is so rare with enterprise software. Usually you just pay your fee and hope for the best.
That's right. You're a customer, not a partner.
Which brings us to the question that can be a little confusing for newcomers. If the software is open source, you know, free to download and use, then why is there a membership model? It feels like a paradox.
It's a great point, and it's the absolute key to its survival. The code is free, yes, but running a program team, offering professional support, coordinating all that development, that takes real money.
So the membership model is for sustainability.
Exactly. It's a collective fund to ensure the tool not only survives, but continues to evolve for the good of the whole field.
So it's less like buying a product and more like, I don't know, supporting public radio. You're funding a shared resource.
That's a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
And members get concrete benefits for it.
Like what?
Well, there are tangible things like getting technical support directly from the program team and access to the user manual. But the intangible benefit is the big one. Having a real voice in the future of the software.
And a seat at the table.
A seat at the table. Plus, by investing in this shared infrastructure, institutions protect themselves from being locked in by a single commercial vendor who could suddenly change the rules or raise prices. It keeps the power in the hands of the users.
It's like an insurance policy and a way to drive standardization all at once. I also noticed how they structured the fees.
Yeah, the tiered levels are important.
Very. They have five different membership levels, so a huge university and a small local museum can both participate and have their voices heard. It spreads the cost fairly across everyone who benefits.
It makes it accessible for everyone.
It really does. So what we have is this hyper-specialized tool that thrives on shared investment and, well, DAVnetic governance. And it's clearly working. The latest release, V4.1.1, just came out on July 1st, 2025. It's just a fantastic model for building critical infrastructure.
It really is a key example of how open source, when you back it with a smart funding and community model, can lead to real innovation and standardization.
But without being driven by profit.
Exactly.
Mm.
And think of the efficiency. Tom Adams from Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory pointed out that because so many institutions use it, they can leverage plugins and tools others have built. They don't have to spend a ton of money on in-house development.
That shared effort saves everyone time and money. it lifts the whole sector.
It really does.
That is just a tremendously powerful model. Yeah. So as we wrap up this deep dive, here's a final thought for you to consider. How does this model-free software sustained by a professional membership compare to the other essential digital tools you use every day, the ones built by massive companies? Does the archive space model maybe ensure a better, more focused response to the actual needs of its users, the archivists? It's something to mull over.
Definitely something to think about.
And that wraps up our deep dive. Thank you again to SafeServer for supporting this exploration. Remember, SafeServer takes care of the hosting of this software and supports you in your digital transformation. You can find out more at www.safeserver.de. We'll catch you next time for the next deep dive.